This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk once again with civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart.
A special occasion prompts this interview. The Court of Appeals just heard arguments on her sentence, whether she can get 30 years or 24 months.
We'll talk with grand jury expert Robert Boyle about three Puerto Rican activists and artists who were ordered to appear before a Brooklyn federal grand jury.
The fight for Puerto Rican independence has gone on for scores and scores of years. The United States has never let up its repression of the Puerto Rican independence movement.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Judge Mukasey, current friend of Rudolph Giuliani, to whom I think he owes his appointment as the Attorney General of the United States, just issued his opinion on waterboarding. Michael, what'd you think of it?
Well, you know, Mukasey owes his appointment also to our dear Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, who supported him and was the only one who voted for him in the Judiciary Committee when they reported him out, as listeners will remember, when he refused to say that waterboarding was illegal. Well, he's been called into Congress to give testimony now in his first few months, and he wrote a letter to them talking about waterboarding, saying essentially that in some circumstances, current law prohibits it, but others, it's a far closer question, not being willing to say whether it was illegal in the past. Then he gets asked, well, how would it be approved in the future? Because Mukasey said he was going to leave that open. And he says the way it would get approved in the future is the CIA would ask for it, the Attorney General would look at the legality, and the president would approve it. Now, that contained in that letter to me was a huge revelation, that the president essentially approves waterboarding. And so when Mukasey now refuses to say it's illegal, a couple of things are going on. One is he says he's not going to look backwards. But, of course, what are crimes except things that happened in the past? So the idea that the Attorney General of the United States isn't going to go back and look at whether waterboarding was criminal is pretty strange business. It becomes less strange when you realize, very likely from his last statement that I talked about the president approving it, that the president himself approved it and would be involved in the criminality of waterboarding, which really explains why Mukasey is not willing to condemn the past war.
I'll go you one step further. I bet you he was vetted on that question as to whether or not he would turn on Bush, and he gave Bush the promise that Bush was cool if he got the job.
Oh, I think there's no doubt. Oh, he was vetted personally. They actually, some of that has even come out. There was an article written on that, and that he was vetted on that particular issue. And of course, where does that leave us with Mukasey? Just remember what he's doing. He is the one who is investigating, well, he's appointed somebody, but under him, to investigate the destruction of the CIA tapes. Now, the Center for Constitutional Rights represents a client named Majid Khan, and according to information that we have, there were videotapes made after these two that were apparently the only two tapes that were made, or the hundreds of hours of tapes of these two people that were made that were all destroyed. So we think there's more videotapes. Do you think Mukasey is going to look into that question? Even though we have pretty clear evidence, it seems to me, that there were other tapes made, he's not, as far as I can tell, looking into that. And he's certainly never going to look into the underlying conduct of waterboarding. And then you hear Leahy, who I find to be a great speaker, but really just
spineless.
Unacceptable, spineless is the right word, saying, well, we're going to ask him serious questions. Isn't the time over in this country for serious questions? Don't we need indictments? Don't we need impeachment? Don't we need something different?
Once Bush is out of office, Michael, can they still indict him for anything? Or
yes.
Cheney?
Sure, they can indict him. Lynn is like the poster child for claiming that lawyers who defend alleged terrorists are terrorists themselves. Lynn is a poster child for trying to intimidate lawyers from taking on tough, difficult cases. Lynn has struggled mightily as her supporters to make sure that's not the message the government sends to all of us. So we're really excited today to have Lynn Stewart with us to talk about her reaction to the recent argument in the Court of Appeals.
Lynn, welcome back once again to Law and Disorder.
My favorite show. Thank you for letting me be here.
What an endorsement. It's great, Lynn.
Well, Lynn, you've been our colleague and our friend and our comrade over the years. We're here to talk about the January 28th appellate oral argument in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals here in New York City. We're very happy to have you on the show. We want to go over with our audience what was said back on that Tuesday in the appellate court.
We're all familiar with the case, and we assume our listeners are, but just in case, let's just do a brief review. In 2002, Ashcroft announced an indictment against you, Lynn.
Right, for a press release that I had made to Reuters in 2000.
During the Reno administration.
During the Reno administration, indeed. Pat Fitzgerald, the later of Valerie Plame fame.
Prosecutor.
Whatever way you want to look at that. Yes, the prosecutor. He was the head of the anti-terrorism in the Southern District at that point, and he's the one who called me and told me that I had violated a set of prison regulations known as SAMs by virtue of speaking to the media on behalf of my client. Within, I would say, 6 months, the whole matter was basically forgotten. I had re-signed the SAMs. I'd gone in to see my client again. It was resurrected with the war on terror. After 9-1-1, they needed bodies. They needed people to say.
Let me go back for a second. So the time when Fitzgerald called you and said, Lynn, you violated SAMs, was what year?
August 2000.
So that was under the Clinton administration.
Under the Clinton administration. Right.
And violating a SAMs, let's be perfectly clear, is not a criminal offense.
It's not the. It's interesting because people seem to think it's a court order or a crime. Actually, it, as I said, it's a Bureau of Prison Regulation that they put into against the client, and the lawyer merely signs on that they're aware of them. I don't want to minimize it, but I would say within the body of these rules and regulations, it said if you break these, you may be denied the right to visit your client, just like so many prison regulations. Except in my case, they waited for 2 years and then they indicted. And they didn't just indict, they said that it was materially aiding a terrorist organization.
Now, when they say they waited, we had a change in administrations.
Yes.
And we had 9/11, and then the current, the Bush administration and Ashcroft, who was Attorney General, decided to look back at what had happened 2 years before.
Right. Well, they wanted to make an example out of it, and they wanted to scare lawyers. So Ashcroft flies into New York. He gets on the David Letterman show, and he announces on the David Letterman show that they've got this red-hot lawyer terrorist. You know, what they had was a 64-year-old grandmother, but they portrayed you as the devil. And when you dehumanize somebody like that, as we know, they're able to victimize them. So they tried you in Lower Manhattan. They had a few blocks
away from the World Trade Center.
Right near the hole. They had a jury, an anonymous jury, that was escorted back and forth from their homes in a police van. They showed, I was at the trial, they had 20-foot-high videos of Osama bin Laden.
This is after the jury had been promised by the judge during the early questioning that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with this, because some of the jury said, is Osama bin Laden, if he's in the case, I might have a problem with this. And then he said, oh, no, he's not in the case. He's got nothing to do with it. And yet he did allow the government pretty much out of the box to use these pictures, this videotape that was found in the basement of my co-defendant.
Yeah, and let's also say that they put you on trial with a translator, and they also put you on trial with another fella who was a practicing Muslim and had ties with people in Egypt and so on, and he was doing stuff that you don't even know about. But in any case, they made an amalgam. They grouped you. They should have severed the trial, but they didn't, and they put you with other people, which made it much harder for you to defend yourself. They put on, what was it, an 8-month trial, something like 17,000 pages of transcript.
Right. I would also say that one of the most remarkable things at the trial, connection with the Osama bin Laden and in connection with other pieces of evidence, The judge instructed the jury 750 times that they were to disregard this evidence as to Lynn Stewart. This was only introduced as to Mr. Sitar, the third party that you mentioned, and that it was not offered for the truth in any case, but merely as to Mr. Sitar's state of mind. So here we have Osama parading at 10 times life size across the courtroom on the individualized TV sets, and the judge telling them, ignore this. Ignore this.
So
750 times.
Well, the jury was out for a while, right?
They were out for about a week. You know, what we know is there was some coercion. One of the black jurors came back a month after deliberations saying that she feared for her life in that jury room and felt she had to convict. But the judge basically brushed that aside. He said she could have come to me at any time. Not exactly true. And I was convicted.
And what were you convicted of?
I was convicted of materially aiding a terrorist organization and conspiracy to materially aid.
And what was that? What kind of aid did you give them?
Well, if you want to stretch this little thing out, it's the theories of the government, and I appreciate you're making the distinction between the Clinton government, and I don't see all that much distinction, but I must say this Machiavellian government is beyond all belief. But their theory was that I provided aid to the IG, which is one of the listed terrorist organizations, in Egyptian
The
Islamic group in Egypt, by virtue of the fact that I brought the words of my client, I provided personnel by virtue of the words of the sheikh in the press release. That was their theory. That's the materially aiding. You know, this is a law that has been under attack. The judge in my case dismissed the first indictment because he said no lawyer could know what the heck they were supposed to do.
And we should make clear that then the government came back with a superseding indictment,
yes,
essentially changing, was it the definition of material support?
No, they brought it under a different section of the law. And this section of the law speaks in terms of knowledge and intent, an added thing. And the judge initially had said to us he intended to charge knowledge and intent. Unfortunately, when we got down to the charge, he charged knowledge, but he didn't charge intent.
So they convicted you of having knowledge of providing these words, this press release. And what did the press release say?
Well, it was more than that, Michael. I mean, their contention is I knew who the sheikh was. I had represented him from 1994. Yusri knew who the sheikh was. He was the subject of his PhD thesis. Therefore, knowing who he was and making the press release indicated that we had knowledge that this was a terrorist and this was going to a terrorist organization.
What did the press release say?
Well, the press release, this is one of the great bones of contention here. The press release said from the sheikh, personally, I no longer support a ceasefire that we unilaterally entered into. That was the first press release. And I can only say to you that it caused a tremendous furor because, of course, the IG was not expecting this and they didn't know how to cope with it. But it got a lot of press in the Middle East, got no press here whatsoever. But in the Middle East, it caused a large furor. And then we were asked to clarify it, at which point the sheikh said again, I'm not telling you to end the ceasefire. I am only saying to you that it does not appear from my vantage point in the middle of Minnesota to be working. He's hearing about people being killed ex-officially. He's hearing about arrests, the tortures in the jail, for which Egypt is famous. And he said, it doesn't appear to be working, so let's raise up the media attention and go forward. But this is for you to decide. You're there on the ground. I don't think he said on the ground. That's a real Bushism. But anyway, and they got this message. Now, the government wanted to say this was a directive from the chief of the IG to resume armed struggle, to start killing people again.
But in fact, the ceasefire never was lifted and nobody was hurt, were they?
Exactly.
But they want to send this now 67-year-old grandmother.
Eight.
Happy birthday to prison for 30 years. And
yeah,
That's what it was all about when we were in the appellate court.
So it was about the sentencing that the judge imposed, and the government's argue is that you should get 30 years rather than the 2 years and 4 months that he gave you.
Right.
Right. Back at the district court, there were, the government, as was said, asked for 30 years, and the judge, after getting 1,000 letters in your support, after talking about what you've done in the bar, how you represent people with no money, everybody in your community, I've always been amazed by that when I go to your talks. There's 1,000 people you've represented on everything from landlord-tenant to, like, small claims court to major felonies. I mean, you're a major community and city and country resource, and I think the judge recognized that. He actually said that.
Yes.
And he basically gave you this 28 month sentence, right? Which means you would do, based on parole, you do...
Probably. There's no parole in feds anymore, unfortunately or fortunately, whatever way you see the parole system. But it's about a 20-month sentence, maybe. Right. It probably is unlikely I could get into a halfway house because of the nature of what I'm convicted of.
But so the government was not happy.
Oh, they were very, very. That day in court, we all can agree that they were.
And when did that sentence come down? What was that?
That was October 2006.
So it's over a year ago that you got sentenced. So then there's an appeal. There's an appeal by the government saying the sentence is
too short,
and there's an appeal by you saying I was wrongfully convicted.
I will say wrongfully convicted, and it was, and you're familiar with briefs in the Second Circuit. They usually, if you send in a 101-page brief, they send it back to you. But this, we put in a 500-page brief.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And in a nutshell, what did you argue about your wrongful conviction?
Well,
500-page brief, I'm going to use it for pressing leaves.
Well, one of the judges said, we're well aware of the weight of your arguments, and they held up these massive
books. Did they really?
Books. Yes.
Yeah.
Judge Sachs said, I think Mr. Dreitel, my lawyer, I think every case in the English language you cited in your brief, so don't worry about it. We'll find it. But at any rate, there were a million issues, as you know. There's a whole free speech issue. There's an issue of stretching the law. There's an issue of selective prosecution. My dear friend Bramsey did the same exact things I did. There's the issue of FISA and NSA wiretaps. We don't even know what happened there. We only know the judge decided against us when we raised it, but there were classified documents involved. I mean, there are a myriad of issues. But what we focused on yesterday was the intent and the knowledge issue, First Amendment.
The idea because that you would need intent and knowledge to have materially aided a terrorist.
Right, exactly. You had to have both. That was that's our contention.
Knowledge wouldn't
and
be
that
enough.
Right, and that never did I have an intent.
Right.
Never. Right. My intent was to serve my client, not to serve his cause.
And what is the First Amendment argument that Josh Dreitel raised about?
It's the fundamental love of the First Amendment lawyers, and that is that, yes, this is a maybe reprehensible speech in some people's minds, but it is not portend imminent danger. It is nowhere near the standard set in Brandenburg or in, I'm forgetting, something hardware store, which was a black boycott of a hardware in Mississippi, because it was a step away, and because nothing ever happened, you hardly could say, and that this was the Sheikh's speech and my speech, and it was due protections. It's where these three things come together, intent, knowledge, and the First Amendment consideration, I think, that was giving the judges a lot of difficulty yesterday.
And Lynn, jumping over to the sentencing part, why do you think Judge Walker was so intent trying to, seem to me, restore that 30-year sentence to make an example out of you?
The judge happens to be a first cousin of George Bush, which doesn't, we don't believe in bills of attainder. We're not saying he's guilty by reason of that. But he was right out of the first starting gate, the first questions he asked. He was making speeches about terrorism and Luxor and 70 people being killed. I mean, it's a very familiar government tactic to anybody that's done terrorism cases. They make a great promulgation of the fear of terrorism, even if it has nothing to do with what we're talking
Luxor,
about.
Luxor, of course, is a big tourist site in Egypt where a number of American and other tourists were killed.
Were killed in 1977, long before this case.
And, of course, upper middle class and middle class people visit Luxor, so yes, I'm sure Judge Walker was very concerned by this.
Yes, and he knew that it would resonate, absolutely, and this is part of what we see from this administration all the time. He definitely is the conservative end of this bench that we had yesterday, Judge Calabresi being probably the most liberal judge on, and Judge Sack sort of being somewhere in the middle here. But I think that he was, and I think they're outraged that they got their conviction against the grandma lawyer, and then this judge let her go. That's how they see it. 28 months to them is nothing.
28 months plus the destruction of your career, which, of course, is the judge, when he sentenced you, weighed that heavily.
Very heavily, yes.
This is your life. I mean, I know you well, and this is – it's your living, and it's what you love to do.
Right.
So they've done that, and 28 months as you get to be older is no small sentence.
Right. I think also that mechanistically, he wants to reinstate the guidelines, Walker.
You need to give us some background on that, because we haven't really talked about – when I clerked in the federal courts, you couldn't appeal a sentence.
Right.
Unless there was some – like such a gross error, like you said, I'm sentencing you to this because you're black.
Right.
You know, unless you did something like that, there was no appeals. And now it's changed. You can appeal a sentence.
Right. Well, they did away with the judge's discretion for many years now, probably upwards of 20 years, and replaced it with a grid. And the grid measured who the person was. In other words, how many criminal convictions? How old was he? How many times had he been to state prison? All of these factors.
And you
they
get
come
points
with a number.
For each.
Yeah, you get points, and you come up with a number. Then they weigh the seriousness of your crime, and where those two intersect, that's your sentence. They did, in more recent times, introduce all sorts of enhancements to this system, one of the biggest being the terrorist enhancement, which automatically added 20 years to any other sentence. In other words, anything that was done to aid terrorism. At any rate, so with the terrorism enhancement, that's how the probation department had come up with the 30 years originally. And that's where that number came from. Of course, you know, the neocons, they're very much into, let's do things, we don't want to look at people. We don't want a judge's read on the baby sitting in the front row waiting for mom to come. We want to do this. We want everyone to get the same sentence. Of course, it's belied completely by what happens in reality, the Scooter Libby's walk, and some poor kid that's selling crack on the corner of 126th Street, he's doing 20 years. Be that as it may, the Supreme Court in November in a case called Gall basically said the guidelines are only advisory. What you must look at is the judge's discretion. So we're all the way back, but now nobody knows what exactly the judge has to do anymore because it's been 20 years since we've had sentences like this. Does he have to get rid of every single factor that might weigh against? In other words, one of the things Walker kept saying, she testified, she committed perjury. That's his assessment. And the judge never mentioned that. He didn't take that into consideration. He wanted to wing it on some technical, and what's worrisome perhaps to me is, will the other two judges go along with this? Will they concede him the sentence if he concedes them some of the other issues? I don't know. I don't know how it actually works. I know they meet, they discuss, they figure it out. At any rate, Walker wanted to say the judge sentenced improperly, that he first got rid of all the terrorism enhancements, and then he just went on his merry way and didn't give any explanations. And, you know, this was a sentencing that took an entire day.
Yeah, no, we were there.
It was like everybody was waiting outside. Nobody will ever forget
that. What's interesting about this sentencing is, you know, of course, in some way we all got a break recently in the Supreme Court where they took these so-called guidelines and factors, and they said the judges could actually depart from them in a greater way in the cocaine
crack cases.
So that, I thought, would actually bring you home to the point where they really didn't have a lot that they could do. But apparently Walker wasn't convinced by that.
Well, I think they're facing a lot of cases before them on sentencing issues. And I think they're trying to find a mechanism for district court judges to sentence at this point. Because this case, as they repeated yesterday, at least 5, maybe 10 times, this is not your usual case. This is not the regular case. This is not a case that comes in front of us every day.
Right.
This is an unusual case with very difficult issues. I think when they're talking about the sentencing, they would like to say judges first have to state their reasons why the guidelines are inappropriate. But what my lawyer kept arguing very brilliantly and very strongly was there is a section of sentencing law that leaves that gives the parameters for sentencing, things like deterrence, things like the condition of the person. In other words, factors that the judge must take into consideration, and this is what Kotel recited when he sentenced. First, he said he didn't think the terrorism exception applied in this particular case. And I think he said that for three reasons, one of which I remember was because there was no harm. No one was injured. No one died as a result of anything. So it was terrorism, but definitely in the abstract. And the other things he said was, and that it was done in the performance of other duties. It was not done just, I'm not meeting behind the sand dune doing this. Can't remember the third reason. But then he went on to detail how on each of these other factors he was fulfilling what he saw as his duty, as Walker kept saying, to pick a number, like they pick a number out of the hat. Yep, 28 months for Lynn Stewart, 20 months for you three. He did give Ahmed Sattar, who was indeed the activist among us, but also, at least in my view, not guilty of the crimes for which he was. He was an internet guy. I mean, he is, once again, crime by internet, crime by newspaper, crime by clippings. He got 24 years. So the judge was not unaware of what parameters he was dealing in.
Well, Lynn, it's been a few days since the arguments last week. How did you feel coming out of it? What's your prediction of how the judges will come down?
Well, the argument took all afternoon. I can say I'm very, very gratified by the large numbers of people that showed up. They actually turned. They had a huge courtroom that sat about 400 people, and they had an overflow room which filled up, and then they turned people away. So we must have had at least close to 1,000 people,
wow.
Not unlike the sentencing, actually. Right. And I saw, you know, people there from St. Mark's Church, from my high school, from college, from comrades at the bar, my political comrades. At any rate, it was a marvelous turnout, and I wish to thank everybody, because I think my politic, like my dear Professor Arthur Kanoy, is we don't win these cases in the courtroom. We do win them by the people turning up and showing, evincing the concern.
No, it's really that the public, at least a certain segment of it, does not consider you to be involved in terrorism. And
absolutely,
they understand what you've done. And that's important for the judges to know that. It's not like, you know.
Yeah, you have a community there.
Right.
Attempts to criminalize me,
exactly,
failed miserably.
And
so
I think
it's extremely important. So we had a very full courtroom. We had argument from 2 in the afternoon till about 5:30. It was for three of us. But when I left with mixed feelings, I will say. I can't say that I can really predict anything that will happen. I know that I've had too many appellate cases of my own, and I know that in a big publicity case where the government thinks it has a lot at stake, judges are prone to hide behind a jury's verdict. I said to my husband, Ralph, this morning, I'm pessimistically optimistic. And he said, no, I'm optimistically pessimistic. You can figure that out. I'm not hoping for too much, but there certainly was, certainly from Judge Calabresi, who really saw through a lot of the government's arguments, really put them on the carpet, I thought, on a couple of things. It could go our way. It could be that they order a new trial. I feel convinced if they did order a new trial in this climate, we could win. We could prevail. I'm not hopeful.
What about on the sentencing? Are you hopeful right. They'll uphold your sentence?
I believe that even if they sent the sentence back, and it would go back to Judge Kotel to be a resentence, that he would then conform with whatever they might require, but come with the same sentence. I think he has enough. Nobody was saying the sentence was wrong. They kept saying he didn't get to it the right way.
Right.
So I think that was a very, very considered sentence. I mean, the man, at one point, Josh Strachel said, this is what we submitted to the judge, and he carried up almost a 2-foot stack of paper, and we had the letters, we had memos, we had psychiatric.
In support of your character.
In support of my character and a view of the case that the judge might not have had otherwise.
Excellent brief that Liz Fink did for you, which I thought was a marvel of appellate advocacy. And
yes,
sentencing.
We had five lawyers working on the. Some of them were known in your audience.
Ellen Yaroshevsky was there.
Yes, Ellen Yaroshevsky worked on Susan Jordan from the West Coast, as well as Josh Dreitel and Jill Shello Levine, who some folks know her dad out in Milwaukee, a Guild lawyer and a very good man. So all of these lawyers, we really worked our tails off on, excuse the expression, on the sentencing, because this judge was meticulous. He read everything.
One scenario is they'll turn it back to Judge Kotel. He'll follow the process they say, meaning he'll go through it again, but it will come out essentially the same way.
That would be my prediction if it happened that way.
Lynn, what can our listeners do if they're interested in showing support for your case? Do you have plans to go on a speaking tour? Is there any way we can draw people in?
Give us your website.
Sure. The website is easy, lynnstewart.org. Lynn is with two N's and an E. And Stewart is S-T-E-W. And actually, yes, we are going on a speaking tour this Friday. I'm flying out to San Francisco.
No, I'm sorry. I was on the last speaking tour with Lynn in San Francisco when was it?
About 2 years ago?
No,
February last year.
Right. And it's so hot. I mean, people come out for you. That's great. I mean, hundreds, thousands, but it's like really taxing. Lynn was going. I only did it for 3 or 4 days. Lynn did it for like 10 days.
We're not quite that long, and it's all going to be right within the San Francisco Bay Area.
Good.
I am getting an award as a fighter for freedom, along with Dennis Bernstein of KPFA.
Is that Jeff Mackler's organizing that?
Yes, Jeff Mackler has organized the whole tour. He is the West coordinator for me, but a lot of this comes from his other work, which is as chairman of the Mumia Committee.
Yeah.
And also there's a songwriter who's getting an award. Anyway, we're getting awards on Super Bowl Sunday.
Ooh.
I had said, Jeff, on the flyer, maybe you just ought to put, we can serve snacks and pizza afterwards and all watch the game if people. But I think the idea is to finish the event before the thing. But, of course, it's the West Coast, so it starts early. We're also doing law schools. We're going to do San Francisco University Law School. And then we're going to go up to Marin County. My good friend and supporter through all of this, Steve Bingham.
He came to our last one. We may have had a split up. Were you and I?
Yeah,
spoke
no,
we
were
there.
It was Michael and myself and Pam Africa.
Right.
Now, there's a dynamic trio.
Oh, yes.
We're like the mod squad here.
I was like the moderate on this crew in terms of my speaking.
Yeah.
I mean, these people, Lynn and Pam, you follow them, you say, okay.
Well, you know what? When you get back, we're going to call you up and see what's going on. We're going to keep track of everything that happens to you, Lynn. And we're here expressing on behalf of our entire audience our solidarity with you, our support, our love, and good luck on this decision.
Thank you so much.
I'm certainly confident on a good part of this decision.
Yeah, I'm feeling that I'm going to, as I have from day one, hope for the best and be ready, understanding politically where the country is at, be able to deal with the worst.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you, Lynn.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We have the power. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, will have an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses, newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awaken to the cry. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise, and we strolled there together, when none to laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming, God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. The people have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power. Use your voice. And when you break one acoustic guitar string, it's good luck. We broke two. Be positive.
Earlier this month, three Puerto Rican activists and artists in New York were ordered to appear before a Brooklyn federal grand jury. The activists are graphic designer Tanya Frontera, social worker Christopher Torres, and filmmaker Julio Antonio Pabon. It is thought that the FBI may also be trying to locate Hector Rivera, one of the founders of the Welfare Poets, a New York-based collective of activists and poets, in order to serve him with a subpoena, too. Joining us today to talk about these subpoenas and also about changes in the law of grand jury since 9/11 is Robert Boyle from the National Lawyers Guild. Bob, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Bob, many of our listeners at BAI and elsewhere around the country know that about a month ago, three Puerto Rican activists and artists were subpoenaed, ordered to appear before a Brooklyn federal grand jury. Can you tell us who these people were and why they got the subpoenas?
Well, there are three Puerto Rican cultural workers who live and work here in New York City with varying levels of previous political involvement. In fact, they don't characterize themselves as political activists. They've supported in the past the idea of independence for Puerto Rico, but are involved in the arts, in day-to-day community struggles, and are not identified as members of any particular organization. And when you ask about why they were subpoenaed, in the context of the grand jury, that's an important question, because under the grand jury law, you can be subpoenaed to testify at a grand jury or provide other evidence for any reason or no reason at all. The government does not have to give a reason. Simply to be served with a subpoena does not mean that you are suspected of or accused of committing a crime. That really abusive power of the grand jury, which makes it such a danger when it's used in a manner to investigate political movements.
Bob, this is, to me, a complete perversion of the original notion of the grand jury. It was set up for entirely different and more idealistic reasons, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it goes all the way back to the Magna Carta, when the nobles in England demanded that the king sign a charter prior to the sovereign, the king, could bring criminal charges against anyone simply on his or her say-so. And so the grand jury was designed as a mechanism, as a buffer between the government and criminal charges, that there had to be some evidence presented to a body of people to determine whether someone would be accused of a crime. And it was incorporated into the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. But over the years, and this is not even a controversial point, it's been recognized as an investigatory tool of the Justice Department. And that's not only the U.S. Attorney's Office, but also all the federal investigative agencies. You hear in common parlance is a grand jury investigation.
It's actually, you know, when I think about this, and I know, Bob, you have a long history with grand juries. I have some, particularly around the Puerto Rican movement and others. But I remember when we used to think about these cases and the coercive nature of the grand jury, someone gave me the image of saying you're called in the grand jury. You then say, well, I don't want to testify because I have a right against self-incrimination, a Fifth Amendment right. And then they give you immunity from, you know, some kind of a narrow kind of immunity. And then you're forced to testify or go to jail. And people can spend long periods in jail, et cetera. And someone once gave me the image of when you have that coercion of jail or talk, it's essentially like district attorney, the prosecutor is reaching tongs into your brain and saying, either you talk, or I'm, you know, and I pull this information out with these tongs, or you go to jail. So it's a really nasty business, in my view. It really is. It's like a star chamber in its own way. It's supposedly secret. It's coercive. And it really, to me, is a relic of a almost medievalism in a certain way, the way it's used.
What started as a prevention of the star chamber has become the star chamber. Grand jury meets in secret. The questions are not disclosed. And a witness, although they have a right to an attorney, do not have a right to have the attorney inside the grand jury room. So the only people in the grand jury room is the witness, the prosecutor, a case agent from law enforcement, and the grand jurors.
Can you tell us where these cases are right now, these three Puerto Rican cases, and then maybe talk a little about the history of grand juries in Puerto Rico?
The subpoenas are now returnable on February 1st. There was an adjournment from the original date, and my understanding is that the attorneys for the people who were subpoenaed are going to be preparing motions to quash the subpoenas, which means technically to dismiss the subpoenas on various grounds, on the grounds that they are an improper attack against their political work, on the grounds that the subpoenas are themselves were derived from illegal electronic surveillance. And also, and this gets into your question, Michael, that the subpoenas really come from a history of the use of the grand jury to attack the Puerto Rican independence movement. I mean, way back in the 1930s, Don Pedro Albizu Campos, who is considered one of the fathers of the Puerto Rican independence movement, was subpoenaed to testify about the movement, refused, and went to jail. It was used to incarcerate probably upwards of a score of people between the 1970s and the 1980s, both here in New York and in Puerto Rico, engaged on various levels of activities in support of Puerto Rican independence. And so when these individuals were subpoenaed, it was looked at by the movement and by the community in that context, that it was in that context of the abuse of the grand jury that gave rise to these individual subpoenas.
On Law and Disorder, a year or so ago, we did a piece on Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was killed by FBI agents brutally in Puerto Rico in September 2005. Is this related to a probe into the rebel pro-independence group? that he was the leader of?
Well, the government hasn't said. Interestingly, Puerto Rican members of Congress, such as Jose Serrano and the island government, have been demanding an investigation into the circumstances of Filiberto's murder. And the U.S. government has refused to do any kind of either informal investigation, let alone a grand jury investigation. But what has happened, as we're seeing, there has been a investigation of people who were sympathetic to the idea of Puerto Rican independence. So they kind of turned it on its head. While there was certainly clear evidence of criminality, I would say, in the murder of Filiberto Ojeda Rios, and which has come out in some informal hearings, there's been no formal investigation by the Justice Department into those acts.
Bob, since 2001, I know that in various segments of the political movements in the United States, including environmental activists and animal rights activists, we've seen a lot of these subpoenas. Has anything in terms of the law of grand juries changed since 2001?
Yes, there has. At the same time that the Patriot Act was passed, post 9/11, there were significant changes to grand jury procedure. Prior to 9/11, a grand jury, information developed in the grand jury could not be disclosed to federal law enforcement except in very specific circumstances and under circumstances which required even approval of a judge. Because the idea of the grand jury was not that it was an investigatory arm of the government. In fact, the FBI and federal law enforcement do not have subpoena power. And so the grand jury, as part of the judicial process, was not viewed as part of that investigatory process. But post 9/11, there was a change to Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure 6E, which was the grand jury secrecy law, which permits, in quote unquote, domestic or international terrorism investigations, that information developed within the grand jury can be turned over to law enforcement as a matter of course. So we maintained in years past that the grand jury was really a tool of the FBI, and that was just what we put out as our propaganda, which was true. Now it's written into the law.
Right. It's really remarkable.
They basically have subpoena power now.
Right. Before prosecutor, the DA or the federal prosecutor who could use it to get an indictment but supposedly not do an investigation, although we knew it was actually a shill for the FBI, but now they don't even worry about the shill business. Basically, they said the FBI, while it can't issue the subpoena, can use all the information. So you're talking about really an FBI that's very close to the prosecutor.
Exactly. We've had situations where the FBI has shown up at locations with blank subpoenas.
It's amazing when that
happens. And filled in the names, and whoever they have, four or five, and maybe there's only three or four there, so they fill in the name of the people and hand them a subpoena. That's not uncommon.
Bob, has there been a lot of support around this issue of these three people that have gotten subpoenas?
I mean, I think that the support from the Latino community in Puerto Rico, in the United States, and in the progressive community has been very heartening to the people who are under subpoena. I mean, just the other day, I read that the Association of American Jurists passed a resolution condemning the use of the grand jury as targeting these people. There's been a lot of outcry amongst mainstream political figures here in the United States and in Puerto Rico against these subpoenas. And I think, and we're hoping, that it causes the government to take a step back and rethink what it's doing. But the support has been phenomenal.
Bob, I remember a few years ago I went to a really wonderful educational forum that you put on grand juries, and something that many activists know but everyone should be aware of is that if the FBI comes knocking at your door, you really shouldn't even answer your name or if you live there, because any even mundane type of information like that can conceivably be used against you related to a grand jury proceeding. Is that correct?
Sure. Well, not only in a grand jury proceeding, but in a actual criminal proceeding. The state of the law is you have no obligation to speak with law enforcement. However, if you choose to speak with law enforcement, even in a give and take, whatever you say can be used against you. And if you say something that's false or that they believe is false, you can be prosecuted for either obstruction of justice or for making a false statement to a federal agent, which is 18 U.S.C. 1001. So there have been situations, for example, where I read one where someone answered the door and was at, they were looking for John Smith, and the FBI agent said, "Are you John Smith?" He said no, slammed the door, and he was charged with making a false statement to the FBI.
Well, that's what happened to Martha Stewart, actually. She was charged with making false statements to the FBI guys that came into her home, and she ended up in a slammer. Don't talk to them.
Yeah, right. They always say that talking to the FBI is like eating potato chips. Once you start, you can't stop because they say, oh, you talked to us this time. You gave us this information. We just want a few follow-up questions. And think about that next time you eat a potato chip.
And at a
minimum, don't talk to the FBI.
I just want to say we're speaking with Robert Boyle, one of the really fine criminal law defense attorneys here in New York City and a longtime leader of the National Lawyers Guild. Bob, I just wanted you to reflect on that sentence that was meted out in Chicago to the Muslim professor who said, I'm not going to speak to the grand jury because it's really what you want me to be doing is to inform on my comrades. I'm not talking to you. I guess there's civil and criminal contempt, and they got him for contempt. And the judge, this 34-year-old judge in Chicago, this heartless judge, Amy San Eve, meted out a 135-month sentence to this man. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it's horrifying. Here was a person whose only quote-unquote crime was that he refused to testify in a grand jury. And if someone does that, you can be charged with either civil contempt or criminal contempt. Civil contempt is not considered punitive, and you're put into jail until you comply with the court order. They say the key is in your mouth.
Right. The keys are in your mouth. You have the keys to the jail.
But also, doesn't the duration can exceed the length of the investigation?
There's certain circumstances where it can, because you can be either subpoenaed again or it can be a special grand jury.
Right. They can extend the grand jury and all kinds of things. So technically, it should be the 18 months or whatever. You've had clients go longer than that, even on a civil contempt.
Right. Or they've been just slapped with a subpoena on 18 months in one day, a second subpoena. But in the situation.
So that's a civil contempt, just so people understand. Civil contempt is you have the keys to the jail. When you start talking, they'll let you out. Or in the rare case, if you can convince the judge that you'll never talk, even if they hold you for 5 years, they will, in a rare case, say, okay, it's not being coercive enough to keep him in jail to make him talk, and we'll let him out. But I don't know. How many cases have you ever had like that?
There's been a few, but mostly people did significant amounts of time in jail. And when they say it's not punitive, I mean, you're locked up in a jail.
Right.
It's the same. You're going, you know, you're locked up. You have strip searches. You're put in a cell. It's the same thing.
What were you saying before, Bob, about the Chicago situation?
In addition to a civil contempt, the government can bring charges of criminal contempt. It's a crime under federal law to refuse to comply with a court order. So if a judge orders someone to testify in a grand jury or provide evidence, the government has the option of proceeding with criminal contempt.
And it can actually do both, right?
It can actually do both.
Even though it seems like there should be double jeopardy, but they can do the civil, keep you in, and then do what, Bob?
And then a criminal contempt. Mm-hmm. And that's happened. Actually, in the Puerto Rican independence movement, it's happened. The scary thing about a criminal contempt is that there is no statutory maximum term.
So that explains Chicago, maybe?
That was a terrorist enhancement section that came into Chicago.
And under the now advisory United States sentencing guidelines, they're no longer mandatory, but judges use them. If there's a contempt arising from a quote-unquote terrorism investigation, the court has the power to consider your term as an accessory to terrorism.
Simply
for not testifying. Now, in Chicago, what was really outrageous about it was that the judge said from the bench, I believe that you are in no way involved in terrorist activities or in actually supporting terrorism when she looked at this professor. And she still gave him 135 months.
135 months is over 10 years, right?
Over 10 years. Wow. It's the longest sentence I think that I'm aware of and for a criminal contempt. And this judge thought that she was doing him a favor. And because she thought that she could, by saying, I don't believe you're involved, I'm only giving you, you know, 11 years, 11, 12 years. The government, I think, was asking for upwards of 20 to 25 years in this case. And I remember, I think you remember, Michael, in the case of the three, there were five Puerto Rican activists in the 70s, the Julio Rosado, Andres sure. Rosado, who were convicted of criminal contempt arising out of investigation into the Puerto Rican independence movement. The government in that case, this was simply for refusing to testify, asked for 20 years in their case. They ended up getting 3 years in prison, which was an outrageously long sentence. But once again, the government felt that they got a break for only getting 3 years. So the criminal contempt specter is a very dangerous one. And that case in Chicago really should be, it's a case that should be, there should be outrage internationally over that case.
Bob, if any of our listeners or their friends or family are served with a subpoena, they should immediately seek legal assistance, correct?
Correct.
They should not talk to the FBI about the subpoena. They should not do anything. They should call somewhere. Where, Bob?
They can call. Well, they can call the National Lawyers Guild if it's here in New York. If there's a local chapter or who's a guild lawyer in your community, you can call the National Office of the National Lawyers
Guild.
And
I'll give that number. It's 212-679-5100. And you could dial extension 11.
And people should also know that they are entitled to court-appointed counsel if you are subpoenaed to a grand jury. So it's that is one of the rights that people have.
And when do they ask for that?
As soon as possible.
We've been speaking with attorney Robert Boyle, one of the ace criminal defense lawyers here in New York City.
And author of the treatise on grand juries.
Also represented Daruba. And was the key lawyer who got him out of a very long prison sentence.
As I started out as a law student for one Michael Ratner, who was also representing him. That's
yeah,
how long
but Michael Ratner. Michael Ratner didn't have the patience of 20 years of Bob Boyle, who actually worked on the case for 20 years and got Daruba Ben-Wahad out of prison based on FBI calls.
Crimes.
What did you say? Crimes, right.
Bob, real nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show. And come back again.
Thanks, Bob.
You.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.